Aloha, everyone. This is Ashley from GoldenGoddesses.org, and welcome to tonight's episode of Threshold to Ascension Radio. I'm really excited to have a conversation with my guest and introduce her to you. I've just got a few housekeeping notes before. First of all, I want to give a shout out to Don and Doug at BBS Radio. They kind of saved my bacon with a little graphic mistake that I made using the mock-up instead of the final artwork. So just publicly, gentlemen, I know it caused you a little bit of work, so I want to thank you for that. For those of you interested in the topic of contact and experiencers and our galactic family, next week's guest, Naomi Cook, is the founder of Project Starseed, a global movement to elevate cosmic consciousness. So I encourage you to tune in then. Yesterday, we just started our new teleconference series. It's an 8-week series, goes until October 3rd, and it's entitled Lucid Dreaming for Star Nation Contact. And if there's time, I want to ask my guest her thoughts on that. Otherwise, we'll do it on the after the show program. In addition, tonight we are giving away one of the books that our guest has written, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. The entry for the sweepstakes will be between now and midnight Wednesday of next week, and we'll announce the winner on next week's show. Okay, so now that we've got all that out of the way, take a deep breath. I had the pleasure of meeting my guest, Suzanne Hansen, at the UFO Congress in Arizona back in February of this year. Her presentation was literally a breath of refreshing liquid light plasma amongst what I felt were dated dialogues of 75-year-old sightings and the ever-evading disinformation detour of demanding disclosure from the governments. Susie's presentation was filled with her own firsthand experience or knowledge, as well as scientific insights on technology, collaboration from her experience and the experience of other contactees, and what I felt was an unspoken but definitely energetically palpable telepathic communication of the importance of stepping up our human consciousness if we truly desire to once and for all have open contact with the technologically and consciously or spiritually, if you will, advanced beings of our multiverse. Suzanne speaks from a strong foundation, having been involved in UFO research for over 40 years, some of that intertwining with her 3D career, teaching in school, being involved in an education, and doing counseling, all which continues to support her mission as she moves forward. Susie is the founder and director of UFO Focus New Zealand Research Center, a nationwide organization that investigates UFO sightings. And she knows a thing or two about disclosure because as director of UFO Focus New Zealand, she lobbied the chief of the New Zealand Defense Forces during the years 2009-2010 for the release of New Zealand Ministry of Defense files, and that was successful with release happening in 2010-2011. Suzanne's focus for the last decade has been bridging the gap between experiencers and the scientific community by encouraging the scientific community to participate in examining the wealth of science and related detail contained in the accounts of human interaction with extraterrestrial species, as well as information about UFO sightings and the details. As always, one of the things I love about Suzanne is she walks her talk. Her critically acclaimed first book, The Dual Soul Connection, The Alien Agenda for Human Advancement, was written including scientist epilogue and commentary by Dr. Rudy Schild, who is look at this title, Emeritus Astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. So not only has Suzanne had extraterrestrial contact since a very young age, she also has knowledge of her own journey and her connection in the duality of the soul, which she'll talk about now. She's blended her own experience with a commitment to collaborating those experiences in a scientific way for the betterment of humanity, and sometimes at her own expense. Susie, it's such a joy to have you. I kind of bungled that dual soul thing, but we'll get into it in a minute. It is such an honor to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much. It's very good of you. Thank you.
Well, there's so much. And as I said to you, as we were kind of preparing for tonight's chat, one of the beautiful things about you and all the different experiences you've had and the wealth of knowledge that you have the courage to bring forth is, where do you begin, right? So I would like to take a few moments. I really want to dive into the three waves of volunteer souls and the dual soul identity. But of course, some of our listeners are just now having the honor of getting to know you. So if you don't mind, would you please just do a little bit of a background of your first memories as an experiencer, as a child, so that there is a little bit of a foundation built?
Okay, well, as a child, I had very early memories, which seemed to be dreamlike, of being in these strange white rooms where I was being taught to do things with my mind. And coupled with this, I would sometimes wake at night, and in my bedroom there would be these three glowing figures. I didn't see any physical features such as eyes or nose or mouth or anything like that. They were like glowing silhouettes. They were very short with large heads. They didn't come up very far above my old-fashioned bed that I slept in as a child. And so I knew that these weren't guardian angels or spirits come to visit me at night, you know, family members who'd passed over, which were two possible explanations my mother put forward to me as a child. But I knew that that wasn't the case, because they would say that they were going to take me with them somewhere. They'd be very pleased to meet me, and they'd be communicating with me without any sound. So my sibling, who slept in the same room, was never woken by any of this. That there was no verbal or vocal discussion between us. So from a very early age, it was clearly a telepathic communication.
So, So as a child, did you remember feeling any fear, or was it just very comfortable and welcoming for you?
No, it was comfortable and welcoming. I never felt any fear. I don't even recall the very first time I saw them, which indicates to me that this was going on from when I was probably a baby. And it became something that I was familiar with, that I wasn't frightened of. It was a normal part of my life, even though it may not have been normal for other people hearing about it. So there was only a feeling of great love and belonging and anticipation as I was waiting to be taken somewhere. And then I would sort of remember no more. The memory would stop there, and the memory would pick up again, often being told to get back into bed. We'd arrived in the room somehow. I had no memory of how. So I was protected as a child from these unusual memories, which could have got me into a lot of trouble if I'd started telling people about them.
Absolutely. And do you remember about how often you would say you experienced interaction?
No, I don't remember exactly how often, but I know that it was quite frequent, because I have a lot of memories of the kinds of exercises, if you want to put it that way, when I was sort of 8, 9, 10 years old, that I was carrying out with them in terms of mind control or stretching the mind and doing unusual things with it.
Well, you know, there's so many beautiful ways that you share those experiences in your book, The Dual Soul Connection. And I know you share this one a lot, but one of my favorite ones is your experience with the joystick. Do you mind sharing that story now?
Sorry, I missed that. The experience with?
The joystick.
The joystick.
When they were giving you the wheel, so to speak.
Oh, you mean on a craft?
Right.
Yes. Well, that was when I was an adult, actually, not childhood. But yes, I was given the opportunity as an adult to fly a scout craft using the mind, and also taught to do it manually with the small lever that would pop up out of the console, and I was taught two methods of flying the scout craft within our atmosphere, and really science. This happened way back in the 70s, and science has now confirmed much of the things that those entities told me at the time about what happens in our atmosphere and why they do certain maneuvers, etc. And we now know that our weather patterns and the electromagnetic field of the planet behaves in a certain way, which is exactly what they were telling me back then.
Well, if what I remember, and correct me if I don't remember correctly, is that they brought you into the room or into the console, right? And they asked you to control it using the joystick, and it was a bit of a
Yes.
bumpy ride.
That's right. Yes, I guess I overcompensated. I have flown a glider in the past, and I overcompensated with the small lever, and the craft became quite unstable, which is what they had been trying to teach me and warn me about. But it was interesting to note that I felt quite confident in being able to fly the craft manually using this lever, because I drive a car, etc., and we just think that if we grab hold of something, we'll be able to control it. But in actual fact, I soon learned that using the mind to fly the craft connected to the organic brain of the craft, if I can put it that way, was much simpler because, as they explained to me, you bypass all of the electric impulses that must come from the brain to tell the muscles and ligaments and the arms to do certain things, which all takes time, whereas using the mind and telepathy was virtually instantaneous.
And then connecting into that unified field, if you will, of the consciousness of the craft as well, and having that symbiosis is just a beautiful example of where we as humans have the opportunity to move into and expanding our consciousness.
That's right, yes. And I think that in the future, we are moving into a telepathic society. We're moving into a society that uses the mind and the brain to operate things. We know that technology is already being developed, and that it will continue to be developed at a much more advanced rate.
Now, there came a time during your childhood, if we go back to that for a second, where perhaps some of these memories or experiences began to not be prevalent in your memory, and then something happened when you were 20. Can you
That's
share a
right.
little bit about that?
Yes, well, throughout my childhood, up to about the age of 12, I think, the contacts were quite frequent. But through my teenage years, they were much less frequent. I had very little memory of them at all. And I think that in part is because of what we go through as a young teen. We go through puberty. We go through a lot of emotional and physical changes. And although I have no doubt contacts were happening, I think the ETs very much leave you alone at that stage, because it's also the time of your life as a teenager where you're doing external examinations and you're preparing yourself to go out into the world. So I'm sure there was some guidance taking place, but possibly less contact. But I guess when I was 20, the time came when they really wanted me to sit up, take notice, and start understanding what was happening and what I needed to do, what was taking place. And that happened when I was a young teacher in my first year of teaching, in the southern North Island in New Zealand. And I was travelling on a lonely country road late afternoon through a sheep farm area. So it was quite remote on a back road, country highway. And the houses were few and far between. And we were travelling along with my flatmate in a little sports car. And looking at the sunlight on the paddocks, and just the trees in the distance becoming black silhouettes as you get to that lovely time of day in autumn where the sun is starting to go down a little, and you've got that golden glow on all the paddocks. We saw some lights ahead of us, two lights side by side, which we thought were probably an agricultural aircraft. They flicked off. We thought, well, the aircraft must have changed direction, maybe going into land somewhere. So we didn't think too much of it as we were coming down out of some hills and onto a long straight. And as we came down and sort of hit the beginning of the straight, the lights appeared instantaneously next to us, adjacent over the hills, maybe a couple of kilometres away. And that was quite disconcerting. At that point, we virtually stopped the car and looked, and quite a heated discussion took place between my flatmate and I, because he was quite sure that it was a helicopter, and I was quite sure that helicopters couldn't move that fast, and that there was something unusual about it. It clicked out and appeared almost instantaneously further down the hills again, then disappeared again, and within seconds it came up behind us. And as it was coming up behind us, we'd just started off in low gear in the car, and it came right over the car, illuminating the car with the brightest possible light that you could imagine, so bright that it was painful to the eyes, and it was accompanied by a sort of a loud, graunching, grinding sound that changed in pitch. And the vibration from that frequency or pitch went right through your body. Basically, it was paralyzing and terrifying. And the next memory that I had was turned out to be an hour and a half later. Mm-hmm. And I remember that in the first instance, when the light came over the car, I remember feeling the car leave the road. And you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach that you get when an aircraft is just leaving the tarmac. And then there was a feeling of flotation. And then I remembered no more, so I must have passed out or something like that. My next memory was of that flotation feeling again, and trying to open my eyes, realizing that everything around me was black. Then the car started up, the headlights came on, and we kind of hit the road. And we were at the far end of the straight. It was pitch black, and we'd lost an hour and a half, which we didn't actually find out how long we'd lost until we got back to our flat. And our other flatmates said, well, where have you been? You're really late. And we had no explanation for it. We couldn't understand it. Our mouths were dry. We felt nauseated. And that was a real wake-up call for me, to begin to struggle with what was happening to me, and eventually realizing and having discovery some years later that I was having contact, and that the entities or beings I was having contact were those that I had loved in childhood.
Now, I'm just curious, did your flatmate experience the same thing, or did he blanket all out completely?
Well, just before the car lifted off the road, I can remember trying to wind the window up. I'd had my window down, and I watched my hand. It was almost like slow motion trying to reach that window winder. And I can remember turning my head, which seemed to take ages, and seeing my flatmate with his eyes shut, his hands on his lap. So he was no longer driving the car, but we did not smash up. So we were lifted off the road.
And did he have recall of the experience as well, or?
He only had the same recall at that time that I had, and that was the light coming over the car, the sound, the brightness, and then later on this feeling of waking up in a dark car, in a completely dark environment, hitting the road at the end of the straight, going over a one-way bridge and wondering what on earth had happened to us. It was quite sad, really, because he was a scientist, and it did not fit his paradigm of his understanding of science, and so he decided he really didn't want to know about it. He tried to blot it out and blanket out, but it really did affect his personality. He went from being a very fun-loving person to quite a morose, angry sort of a person who eventually left the flat and we lost contact.
Well, I think those are, very powerful experiences for anyone if without any kind of a baseline. And that's one of the beautiful things about your organization, Communicator Link, which provides an outreach for people that have had contact experiences. Do you want to just talk briefly about that?
Yes, Communicator Link is a little website I set up. We offer support and information for people who've had a range of experiences, not just contact experiences, but near-death experiences, paranormal experiences, spirit experiences, etc. I am also a medium. I don't generally like to use that term because it has certain connotations, but I have been since early childhood. It's been a natural part of my life. So I do understand that whole other paranormal realm as well that many experiencers speak of. So Communicator Link has got two colleagues who work with me. There's Brian Dickerson, who is an hypnotherapist trained by New South Wales Police in Australia. He's also a scientist, so he's and a long-time sighting investigator in New Zealand. So he's got quite a broad background in the area, as I have. And Cheryl Gotchell, of course, is a very long-time researcher also over in Australia, New Zealand's nearest neighbour. And they're two very good friends and colleagues of mine. Cheryl is very knowledgeable about near-death experiences, having had one herself. She's also supported experiencers and abductees for decades now and has an organisation in Queensland called UFO Research Queensland that investigates UFO sightings as well.
And it's such a powerful resource for people to have to reach out to, you know, especially as in these times more and more people are having memory recall coming back. And in just a moment, we're going to dive into the ET technology and the corroborative evidence. But I would like you to just take a moment. And in your book, Dual Soul Connection, you talk about contactees, abductees, and experiencers. Can you help our listeners to understand if there's a difference between those terms?
Yes. Well, we look back in history when we use these terms. I see that a lot of people these days are calling themselves contactees, but really they need to do a little bit of historical research to find that that term is actually already taken in this field. Contactees were people who reported contacts back in the 50s, as early as the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s. And those contacts were generally with human-looking Nordic kind of beings. They were generally loving and informative, very gentle, loving contacts. And then onto the scene came abductees around about the 70s. And abductees reported having somewhat less congenial contact with a variety of species, but largely the greys. And then the experiencers came along after that. Experiencers began by breaking away from the abductee group and saying, well, we've had experiences with the greys, as I have, Ashley, but they were positive, loving, and constructive. So we don't wish to be called abductees. We'd like to be called experiencers. So we've got those three quite distinct groups. And certainly at some of the conferences I went to back in the 90s, I know that those groups were very, very almost antagonistic towards each other, but I think that there's a lot less of that now. We have a much broader understanding of the kinds of contacts people have had. And, of course, we've had publicly learnt about MyLabs and other kinds of abductions that have been unpleasant and traumatic for people.
And you brought that up. I just would like to ask just a little bit more expansion on that. What do you say? I know your book is filled with just the beautiful interactions you've had with the race of greys that have been your main contact. How do you open that conversation with people who say that all greys are negative?
Well, you know, if they make a statement like that, it's a blanket statement, especially if they've got someone standing in front of them who's saying, well, my experiences weren't like that. But I do acknowledge that that there are a lot of people, certainly people who come to us, contact us through Communicator Link, who call themselves abductees and have had traumatic experiences. There can be a variety of reasons why those experiences may be traumatic. And I've written about this in articles. You know, it can be the way they perceive it. It can be that they've cut themselves off from the telepathy, so they think that it's all bad. Or there are people who do report very very nasty, very traumatic experiences. And I think that in a lot of researchers today are pushing the barrow that all experiences are positive, and that if you've had a negative experience, well, there's some reason.
So Suzanne is actually in New Zealand, and they do have a little bit of a weather challenge there. So let's see if we're still live. Don,
Joseph, and I'd like to talk with you about a product called Stop Itch. It's an all-natural product that stops itching and scratching instantly from all types of rashes, including eczema, psoriasis, dermatitis, poison oak, all bug bites, and it's safe for kids and babies of all ages. And for a limited time, it's half off at www.theskingod.com or 888-391-5432. Thank you.
Aloha again, everyone. So just take a deep breath. We're all looking forward to Mercury and Mars coming out of retrograde. So, Susie, we were kind of talking about understanding and honoring that there are some individuals who have had less than pleasant experiences. And there are some people saying that they're only benevolent ETs. So that's about where we picked up. And we'll just trust that the guidance you'll have to bring in will be exactly where we're meant to pick up again.
Yes, Ashley, there are quite a number of researchers who are making claims that all contact, in their belief, is positive. But really, I think they need to start listening to the abductees and experiencers, because abductees, many of them will tell you that they've had quite traumatic experiences. And I don't like to see a group of people who've had some form of contact being marginalised like that. Even if their memories are only negative because they've misconstrued them or they haven't remembered them right or whatever, I think those people still need assistance and support and help to move them forward to a place that's more comfortable for them. So I think that we don't want to rush down the road too quickly that all experiences are positive, because that assumes the fact that we know every kind of species that might be out there and their agenda towards us.
Exactly. And that's the beauty of an organization like Communicator Link, a safe place for people to share what they've been through and to receive guidance or talk with people that have been through other types of experiences. So thank you for that. Now, you talked about that experience when you were 20 and your flatmate, who was the scientist, and the impact it had on him. But one of the things I really love about your work is that you are really focused on how bringing the scientific community into this discussion is important. You know, in a way, the scientific community, at least a lot of it, needs to take off their paradigm blinders and really understand that corroboration, as you say, isn't going to be coming back with pictures on your iPhone of the craft. Yes. So would you go into a little bit more about the corroborative evidence of your contact experiences and what the top two or three ones that you had perhaps and discussed with Dr. Schild, or however you would like to language it?
Okay, well, you certainly, I think, if we're looking at forms of evidence that are acceptable to the public or acceptable in a court of law, etc., about the closest we can get as experiencers or abductees to something acceptable is something that is a detail that can be corroborated by another experiencer somewhere else in the world. And that detail needs to be something that's not a broad trend in contact experiences, like the manner in which you might be taken on board a craft in a beam of light. That's become very well known now. It's very well accepted. I'm talking about maybe a specific piece of technology or a specific implement or piece of apparatus that two people who've never met before on different continents are able to describe identically. And that's not just the physical description of the object, but what it can do, what it might feel like, and what consciousness may be involved in operating it, or what experience that person has had with that on the craft. And so I guess with my own experiences, having had many years as a UFO sighting investigator in New Zealand, looking at details, and doing taking a very investigative and forensic approach to looking at UFO sightings or landing sites or whatever, I've tried to do the same with my contact experiences. I've tried to take them apart, look at them in detail, question them, research them, talk to other experiencers, and really understand them in the best possible way that I can. And for me, naturally, that is going to involve, because I've had a lot of memories of using and observing technology, that's going to involve seeking some scientific support or corroboration or validation. And I certainly got that when I first approached Dr. Rudy Schild some years ago to ask him if he could help me to understand some of the technology that I was explaining and some of the information I was talking about to do with space and the universe. So I think it's very important that that we document these kinds of things, that these little details are carefully documented, because you never know when you're going to run across someone who's going to have that little piece of corroborative evidence. And as I described in my book, I was researching for a speech one day, sitting at my computer, and I just kind of haphazardly typed in the name in the Google search, the name that I'd given to a kind of elevator that I'd used on a craft, which I called a light elevator, liquid light. And I typed in liquid light, and lo and behold, up came a drawing that was almost identical to my own drawings of this elevator. And I contacted the person associated with this website and asked them, well, is this from an experience, contact experience you've had, or is this just an imaginative drawing? And I heard back almost immediately saying, no, this was an experience I had in 1997. And so there followed a discussion over email of how we perceived this piece of apparatus, and you just wouldn't believe the way we used the same descriptions and terminologies and adjectives to describe it. So here was this first piece of real corroborative evidence that I'd discovered. And no two people can imagine something on opposite sides of the world, something so specific with so many specific details. And that really woke me up to the fact that I really must work at getting scientists more interested in the subject, and particularly in what experiencers are able to describe.
I know the listeners are dying to know a little bit more about this light elevator. Can you describe it for those that perhaps haven't been on a craft or experienced that kind of a thing?
Okay, well, I was taken on various versions of it, if I can put it that way, from childhood. But the most stunning one is the one where you get in on your own or with another being. So what it looks like is like a column of perspex, glass-like perspex. It tends to curve at the top and the bottom where it meets the ceiling and meets the ground, as if it's got that widened foot at the bottom for stability. And within this column of light, which has a sliding door that opens on each level of the craft, within this column of light, there's what I describe as light that goes up and down almost at the same time. You can see flashing light. It's a whitish blue color, and you get these beautiful blue flashes of light going up and down, moving and swelling, just like almost like liquid, sparkling liquid inside. But when you open the door, there isn't any liquid in there. It's this very odd form of light. So you telepathically command the door, it opens, and you step in. There's no floor, because we're talking about a column of light contained within this perspex-like form. And once you get in there, you're suspended in what feels like liquid against the skin. It's almost like a velvet, soft, silky velvet-like touch against the exposed skin. And you telepathically think a symbol that's associated with the level that you want to go to. And there's a moment of blackness. That's how I experience it anyway. And the next thing, you're on another level. You're standing there with no floor under you, suspended. The door opens and you step out. So, you know, it's some kind of electromagnetic combination of light and goodness knows what. But I know that in the UK in 2016, a press release was put out about how they've made their first steps, scientists have made first steps towards producing a liquid light. So as to whether this is a lead-in to what I experienced back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I don't know. But the good thing is that I've now found two experiencers, the gentleman I talked about earlier who I emailed in the States, and another young experiencer in Australia who is able to describe the same piece of technology. So I guess we can safely say this piece of technology exists and we three have travelled in it.
And some of the other beautiful things you talk about in the book are things like the roll-up plasma screens and the movable screens, many things that we're now seeing being introduced that you experienced decades ago in your journeys on the craft.
That's right. And when I spoke at the UFO Congress in Phoenix in February, I was asked to speak specifically on the ET technology. And that was a good exercise for me to do because normally I would incorporate some of the technology in my speech about the spiritual aspect and the childhood contacts. But I sort of extracted all of that out and really looked at some of the most stunning stunning technology that I've seen and used on craft and showed how decades later we are only now just beginning to produce something that resembles it. So, you know, way back then I was able to describe it in layman's terms and now we humans are producing it.
Which is another form of the corroborative evidence that perhaps our scientists need to expand their minds to accept as the proof, because it's not going to be 3D proof that you're used to. As I mentioned when we started, you've got so much information and we're only going to be able to touch on it during the show. But I do want to kind of shift direction now and go into more of the consciousness side of it, which I know is very near and dear to your heart. And your book, in reading the chapter 9 on the soul origin, where you talk about the memory of being between lives and stating that guidance is perhaps a better word than free will. Can you talk a little bit about that as far as the journey of incarnation and the choice that you remember making?
Yes, well, a lot of experiencers and abductees will tell you that from time to time you get a flashback memory that just is quite riveting and it just stops you in your tracks and you think about it and you examine it. And I experienced such a memory some years ago, but it was actually a memory of before I incarnated into this life. And I could see myself as a purple ball of light, and I was floating with a blue ball of light. But in front of us was this kind of council, is the way I would describe it, a group of entities, souls, balls of light, strange-looking creatures, human-like-looking beings that I understood in this form as a ball of light were a spiritual governing body for our planet that we needed to go in front of and pass through and pass before in our planning stages of incarnating into this life or into a life on this planet. And it's interesting to note that some years later, it took me about 20 or 30 years to decide to do some regressions and to fill in some of the gaps. I have a lot of extensive conscious memory of contacts, but there were some blank patches in some of those experiences, and I investigated a few of those, and it included this particular experience where a much broader picture came out of me as a soul choosing a life that had been presented to me. I had been presented with several, and I kind of narrowed it down to two. And then I was allowed, using consciousness, to look into those lives. So almost futuristically, I was able to see snippets of those lives, some of the hardships, some of the joys, some of the challenges, etc., that I would face in both of those lives. And it's interesting to note that the other life I was considering was as a sponge-like form on a newly developing planet. And at that stage, I didn't know, it's only just come out, scientists have stated recently, that one of the earliest forms of life on a newly developing planet is going to be a sponge-like form. So there's another little bit of corroborative stuff there from what I talked about years ago. So I went before this, I chose this life as Suzanne Hansen, and I went before this governing body. I call it the UGB for short, the Universal Governing Body that oversees the incarnation of souls into this planet. And it's interesting to note that the discussion that took place between myself and them and the blue ball of light that was with me, who was also going to be incarnating as part of my plan of life plan and their life plan, the decisions were being made largely by this governing group. They had the final say as to whether they thought I had brought enough with me from my previous lives, from my little spark in the field of consciousness that contained all the previous lives I've lived. And I had to extract out from that greater pool of wisdom from other lives, I had to extract out what I thought was going to be useful for this life. And they examined this, they looked at the life, and they came to the decision, a consensus between all of us, that yes, they felt I could do this. So then they said, did I want to do it? And I said yes. And I was then offered the opportunity of being enhanced in some way and being part of an agenda, being part of a program working with extraterrestrial intelligence who are seeking to assist us to raise our spirituality and evolve faster on our planet for a variety of reasons. And I was offered the opportunity to work in that program, and I said yes. And so here I am in my life, having contact with the species who are assisting, one of the species assisting in that agenda.
And you go further in the book and you talk about how through this universal governing body, and there's a term that the Greys use for the influx of souls drawn to incarnate on Earth at this time with the aim of assisting our planet with its evolution. And how do you summarize those different groups, the term that they use? The three waves of the voluntary souls. Yeah.
Well, I first learned about the three waves when I was 8 years old. And I was talking about the three waves back in the decades ago, long before other researchers came out with this same concept. I was told as an eight-year-old about the three waves. I was given a huge download of information about it as an eight-year-old when I met the soul of my future son, the son that I would eventually have when I was older and married and had children. And that download went into my subconscious where it sat for many years. But when my understanding and realization of what I was a part of came to the fore, and I started to wake up, if I can put it that way, to what I was really here for, that all that information really started coming out into the conscious mind and a greater understanding of it. So I was informed about three waves of souls that were coming into the planet for a variety of reasons. They were part of this agenda that I write about. But they weren't just incarnating to help out on the planet, as many souls have done. They were coming in to help out within a specific agenda, working with ETs, and with a commitment to complete certain tasks. So the first wave came in late 1800s, right through to like the 20s, 50s, early 30s, etc. And they had two components to that first wave. There was innovators and the enlighteners. And it's quite a complex structure that I described to do with the three waves, but I'll try to be brief with it. The innovators were those who were in the early healing arts, the early spiritualist church, the early disclosures, particularly in the Western world, of spirituality and some of the Eastern philosophies that have been around a very long time. Whereas the enlighteners, which is quite a smallish group, are actually what some researchers would describe as star kids, crystal kids, indigo kids. So in my understanding of the three waves, this whole StarKids thing is much smaller than what some researchers like to put out there. They are saying that there's, you know, a great deal of StarKids out there. My understanding is that they're a specific group here for a specific reason, and they're not a massive group. The second wave is what I'm in, and that's the pioneers and the communicators, and that's the biggest group of souls that came in this agenda. It's sort of a finite group in that they came in around the 40s and 50s, 1940s, 1950s, right through to around about the 70s and 80s. So that's a very large group of people. It includes abductees and experiencers. And a lot of those people now are waking up and realizing that they need to talk about their experiences to people who understand, and some of them are going to go on to publicize those experiences, I believe, until we reach a bit of a critical mass where it will become normal in people's minds, if I can put it that way. It will become accepted. The third wave is very special. Again, it's quite set apart. The third wave came in much later on, around about the late 70s and 80s, and my son is in that group, and they are the implementers. So the whole agenda that I talk about, the catchphrase for the agenda would be change from within. So these ET races, not just the Greys, there's other species working with them. The Greys are kind of the front guys. They are trying to get us to change ourselves, to working with us to engender change from within our own society, not imposing it on us. And the changes that will take place coming into the future from now onwards, because some of those third waivers are now in their 30s and early 40s, so they're getting into positions of power and authority in a positive sense, where they will be able to make sweeping and quite specific changes to the world and to the environment, etc., and maybe pull us out of some of the scrapes that we've got ourselves into. But within that group of the third waves, there's a very small specific group that I have called the fourth intellect, what the Greys actually called the fourth intellect. And these are the ones who are working with the Greys in particular and other species, creating hybrid groups or bridging groups that will be able to communicate with humans in the future and be that bridging contact, so that we don't actually have immediate contact with some of the species, because some of their physical appearances can be quite confronting. So these hybrids being produced are very much closer to us, but very advanced in many ways. So there's been some genetic use of human genes to create this race. And I'm not talking about the hybrids that many people are talking about out there and researchers are writing about. I have a very different take on it to that, and that's what will be the subject of my next book.
Ah, we'll be looking forward to that. I know that you've been contemplating that, and so it will happen in divine timing. And I think that's important, because there is a lot of misunderstanding, and from your own personal experiences and the context that you've had. Now, when we talk about these waves, I'm sure our listeners can relate to some of the different traits or characteristics. And I know that you said that not everyone on the planet obviously is in one of these waves. We're all here for different purposes. And your book goes into that much deeper. But one of the things is very common amongst the second wave is feeling out of place, feeling like they don't belong anywhere, and feeling like there's something important they need to do in this life, but they yet don't know what it is. What's your guidance to people that contact you that have that strong passion within but haven't quite gotten the full picture of what they're here to do?
Yes, well, I think the main thing that I put forward to people, and I keep it quite simple, actually, is to have patience. Mm-hmm. Because I liken it to a massive network of wheels that are turning, cogs that are turning. And I remember as kids, my two boys had a construction set where they linked a whole lot of wheels together and you turned a little lever and slowly, slowly all the cogs would start to move. But it would take a while of turning the little lever until all the outer cogs on the construction started to move. And I think I can liken this whole situation with the second wave, the communicators, I can liken it to that. And that if you've come in here with a task to do and you don't feel you're doing it yet and you're just beginning to realise that there's something you need to do, then, you know, lead a good life and take an interest in everything around you and develop passion for the environment and recycling and healing and all of those wonderful things that are going to raise the spirituality and vibe of the planet. But when it is your time to start turning as a cog, it will drop in front of you all of a sudden. And it will happen if it hasn't happened yet. But I think a lot of people try to make it happen and then they'll go up a blind alley and waste a lot of time and energy. But, you know, if you've got a specific job to do and you're part of these three waves, it will happen. It's just a matter of patience and the timing. And the Greys have always talked to me about this importance of timing, how timing is of the essence, and they are constantly examining what is happening on the face of the planet, the changes in our psyche, the changes sociologically and environmentally in every aspect of our lives. They're observing this and they're adjusting the timeline, so to speak, accordingly.
I always joke and say I forgot to pick up the patient's chip on the way into the planet this time around. And I know many, many feel that same way. You know, there's just so much information in your book and we've just briefly be able to touch on it. I know that your throat is acting up. So listeners, we may or may not do the after the show recording now. I'll check with Susie when we complete and I will send out a newsletter. It will be on the YouTube site when we do that. But I do want to take, we're coming up to kind of our time, but you're going to be in traveling in October. You're going to be, I think, in Europe, and then you're coming to the States. We do have listeners from around the world. Do you have time to just give a brief update of where you're going to be when?
Yes, I'm going to be going to Finland, to speak in Finland in October, in mid-October, and then on to Denmark, where I'll be meeting with researchers there. Then I fly through to the States, and I'll be in Atlanta with a researcher for a while, couple of researchers for a while, doing private research. Then I'll be speaking at the I'll be speaking at the my mind's gone blank.
The New Mexico event.
Yes, in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, and then I'll be going on to Oregon and speaking to a group up there.
So you'll be out in Eugene, and is that a private event, do you know, or is it a public event?
It is a group that meets, but I think it's going to be made a public event, and there is a possibility of a speech in Portland. But Stargate to the Cosmos conference in New Mexico and Albuquerque is a four-day one starting on the 25th through to the 28th of October. And I'll be doing something on each of those days at that conference.
Fantastic. Is your schedule on your website or?
It's going to be.
I know.
Been unwell and I just haven't got around to doing it.
No, I know that one exactly. But no worries. I do have the schedule. So if anybody's interested, you can send me an email through the BBS radio site or through the Golden Goddesses website. And I'll be glad to share Susie's schedule.
And they can go to my Facebook page, Susie Hansen. And I'll be putting that on there this weekend, the whole schedule.
Now, I don't know if it's possible. One of the things we were going to touch on is what the ETs told you about our future understanding of energy, sustenance, and disintegration. Is that a longer conversation than the minute we have left?
Well, make it a minute.
All right.
make it a minute, just brief. In the future, they've told us that we will be able to absorb the energy from a plant rather than the sustenance, rather than eating the plant itself. We will use intuitive healing a lot more, which is something I've done on quite a bit of on the craft, rather than the medical side of it. We'll be intuitive, and that in the future we will learn to disintegrate our bodies and put them back together again at will.
May it be so, and may it be. That's very well done, Susie. You've done this once or twice. So everyone, I do want to, you know, if you're drawn to what Susie's talking about, or you feel you may resonate with one of the waves, oftentimes reading information like that helps to activate. So the book is Dual Soul Connection, The Alien Agenda for Human Advancement, and it's available on Amazon and in a Kindle form. And again, we are giving away one if you go to goldengoddesses.org and just fill out the entry form. You've got some time if you're listening to this on the archive. The entries will close Wednesday, August 22nd at midnight. And on next week's show with Naomi Cook, we will actually announce the winner and then get it in the mail to you. Susie, in the minute before we get played off, is there anything else that you really wanted to communicate and share that we haven't had a chance to do so yet?
No, just that I think a lot of people are actually already doing their task in one way or another, and others have yet to find it. And I wish everybody well in their endeavors.
Well, thank you so much for all that you are and all that you do. I know that you've had your own initiations and challenges and individuals and organizations that tried to shut you down, as many of the communicators have been attacked at different times. So thank you for continuing to follow your passion. And
thank
read
you,
the book
Ashley.
To listen and find more out about the dual soul identity. Thank you, everyone. And it's been an honor speaking with you. Have a beautiful week. And join us next week for Naomi Cook from Project Starseed. This is Ashley. From my heart to yours, keep shining your light. Mahalo.